Cervical cancer is one of the few cancers that has got a very readily detectable and treatable precancerous stage. And we need to have a very thorough understanding of the natural history of this disease so that we know when we have to intervene, which are the true precursors, so that they can be managed in time. And ultimately, what we want to achieve is we want to have an impact on the incidence and mortality of the disease. So there has been a lot of research in looking into the etiology of the disease. So initially, the risk factors identified were early age of marriage, early age of sexual intercourse, multiple partners. So all these risk factors, they indicated that there must be a strong connection with the sexual behavior. The disease must be having a strong connection with the sexual behavior. Then a lot of studies followed. Epidemiologists started looking into the reason. And the first initial clues, it was given by an Italian physician. And he showed that the disease was very common in nuns, very rare in nuns, whether it was in very common in among female sex workers. So this, all these led to the suspicion that there must be, that this disease must have a sexually transmitted agent. See, in 1940s and 50s, they thought that they put the blame on smegma. Could that be the reason? Then in 1960s and 70s, they thought probably it is the herpes simplex virus. That could be the reason. But then in 1976, in the late 70s, this gentleman, Nobel laureate Zurhausen, he first published his hypothesis saying that cervical cancer is caused by human papilloma virus. And subsequently, a lot of state-of-the-art HPV detection techniques have come up, and they have also found that human papilloma virus is present in almost 95 to 100% of adequate specimens of cervical cancer. So that confirmed that human papilloma virus is the necessary cause for cervical cancer. This is how the virus looks like. It's a DNA virus with a double helical structure. Has got a capsid. This is non-enveloped. It does not have the lipid membrane. And two major capsid proteins are there. One major capsid protein and one minor, L1 and L2. And this protein is responsible or sufficient or necessary, whatever you say, is necessary for almost 75, forming the almost 75% of the capsid. And on the capsid, there are multiple capsomeres. Look at those star-shaped capsomeres out there. So, those are the capsomeres on the capsid. Till date, now more than, say, 150 types of HPV has been identified. And of that, only 40 types are anogenital. And if you broadly divide, some of them are oncogenic, they have the potential to cause precancers. Some are probably oncogenic, and these are the non-oncogenic. These are the low-risk types. They are responsible for causing 90-95% of the anogenital warts. And of the oncogenic, several oncogenic types, the most important genotype, HPV 16 and 18, they are responsible for causing more than 70% of the cervical cancer. If we talk of the strength of association with the cause and the disease, strength of association basically means the magnitude of the incidence, the ratios of the incidences. Now, if we say that, we know that smoking causes lung cancer. So, if we say the risk of having lung cancer among smokers is 10. Risk of, if you see the liver cancer, risk of having liver cancer among the HPV positive patients are 50, then the risk of having CA cervix, cervical cancer with HPV is around 100. So this is probably the, this strong association is probably the maximum, the strongest ever association found in human cancer. And if we take the HPV-16 type alone, the strength of association is much, much higher. HPV predicts CN, yes. See, HPV, so many studies have now shown that HPV infection occurs much more, before the development of a cervical intraepithelial neoplasia. So this temporal association between HPV infection and CIN, it suggests that there must be a role of HPV in the pathogenesis of CIN. See, this study looked into the they followed up a cohort of psychologically negative women over a period of years, say 24 months, and they found that the risk of CIN2/3 cervical cancer is 11 times much higher than the HPV negative women. And much of that extra risk was due to the HPV 16 or 18 only. So this study, it suggests that the genotype of the HPV 16, 18 and persistence of this HPV is a very important determinant for subsequent development of CIN or cancer. Now, how does this infection cause the carcinogenesis? See, when HPV infection occurs, most of them is cleared by the host cell-mediated immunity. But in small number of cases, because of the insufficient immunity, the human papilloma virus, it enters and integrates with the host genome. And the very first genes that are expressed are the E6 and E7 oncoproteins. And these two together, by inhibiting the P53 and the ribosomal protein, we know this is a tumor suppressor gene, causes the uninhibited replication of cells, leading to the precancers. How does HPV enter the cell? Through microabrasions or micro tears caused on the epithelium. And when it enters, first affects the basal cell. And as I said, much of this infection is cleared on its own. Or maybe some mild cellular ataxia, which also gets cleared on its own. It's only the persistent HPV causes the changes. Then what happens? The basal cell layers, they start multiplying. They divide and their progenies, they carry a lot of viral particles in it. So they keep on multiplying, and as they reach the superficial cells, by the time the full maturation, differentiation is there, each cell has thousands of viral copies in it. The low-grade lesions, when the changes are limited to the lower one-third of the epithelium, we say those are the low-grade lesions. And when it is further differentiation, it goes up to the middle third, to the whole thickness, those are the high-grade lesions. And when there is breach of basement membrane, we call it as invasive. Now, how does cervical neoplasia will be expressed in terms of nomenclature, the terminology? The various terminology has been used interchangeably. Initially, it was a dysplasia system. So in dysplasia system, when the changes were limited to the lower one-third, they said it was mild dysplasia. When it was up to the, say, half of the epithelium, it was moderate dysplasia. The severe dysplasia, maybe say more than two-thirds, leaving just a little bit of epithelium there, that is severe dysplasia. And the whole thickness was carcinoma in situ. Then came the CIN system by Reichardt. And the change that was seen was, what the CIM system did was they combined severe dysplasia with the carcinoma in situ, and they called this CIN3. So lower one third, it is CIN1, half of the epithelium CIN2, and full thickness of the epithelium involved, that is CIN3. And now another system, that since the squamous intraepithelial lesion terminology again came, and what they did was they divided the whole spectrum into a two-tier system. LCIL that said it is CIN1, basically CIN1, along with some HPD, the polycystic changes. And XCIL, so all that CIN2 and CIN3, they clubbed together, and that was HCIL. So the two terminologies they use this in USA very much. So LCIL and HCIL. So we will be using the CIN terminology. This is to show you the importance of transformation zone. We talked of how to identify, and we have to know the transformation zone in its entirety, because this is where the cervical carcinogenesis occurs. This is where the HPV infection occurs through the micro abrasions. This is the zone. Can you identify the? This is the entire limit of the transformation zone. See, the natural history of CIN is very similar to that of the HPV infection. As we said, the most of the HPV infection clears on its own. So very few of them persist and progresses. CIN also, the low-grade lesions, maximally they clear on its own. And only the true precursors, these are the lesions that will progress. And the entire spectrum takes, say, 10 years, 15 years time in a woman's life. So what is important is that we are getting that many years to screen a woman, identify the true precursors, and treat them. So we have a long time to detect these cases. So we need to know which are the true precursors. This is a study that combined studies done over 40 years. This combined by Oster, basically done by a pooling of studies, and he showed that majority of CIN1, so 50% of them, they regress. Only a very small percentage, 11%, they progress. And compared to that, CIN3, 12% they progress to the invasive disease, and very small percentage, 32%, regresses. So he showed that this shows that CIN1 is a relatively benign disease. It can, most of them will regress on its own. We don't need to do anything. But the CIN3, these are the true precursors, and they need to be treated. And, you know, doing research in natural history has got certain ethical problems also. That we cannot keep on following a CIN3 or carcinoma in situ till they progress to cervical cancer, and then it says how long does it take. The studies that looked into the how many of the CIS progress to cervical cancer, those are basically the women who are not treated because of the CIS and then diagnosed as cervical cancer later date. And there we see that roughly 30 to 50% of the CIS the progress to cervical cancer. So to summarize, HPV infection, most of them, HPV related, whatever changes, even if it occurs, most of them are regress, about 60% they regress within 2 to 3 years time. Only about 15% they progress to the high grade, CIN2, CIN3, carcinoma in situ, and of them, 30 to 70% in progress in 10 years' time to invasive cancers. So the CIN1 does not need any, HPV infection does not need any treatment. CIN1 does not need any treatment if we can ensure systematic follow-up. But the true precursors, the CIN3, CIN3 and the these are the lesions, CIN2, CIN3, these are the lesions that should